September. Next week, Giles Chance, a professor from Beijing University's Guanghua School of Business, will be talking about China and the credit crisis. The week after that, we have both Ronald Arcully, the chairman of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. That's on December 9th, and a day later, Albert Ho, the chairman of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, and is going to be here talking about Hong Kong's human rights lawyers. But on a more somber note, before I introduce today's speaker, I did want to mention that I believe this is the first club function since Tuesday, when we learned of the appalling massacre on Mindanao in the Philippines. The FCC offers its condolences to the friends and families of the victims of the tragedy, including, according to Reporters Sans Frontières, as many as 26 of our journalist colleagues who were killed on Tuesday. So please do keep them in your thoughts and prayers as well. This afternoon, we turn our attention to an even more dangerous part of the world, to Afghanistan, and we welcome Patrick Hennessy, author of the Junior Officers Reading Club. I do have to tell you, however, that Patrick is one of these speakers I kind of hate, because nothing makes me feel older than introducing a man of his experience and accomplishments, who also happens to be 12 years younger than I am. Patrick was a career military officer who served in hotspots and battle zones, including Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. His book has been very, very well received. I'm sure you've all seen the reviews if you haven't read it already. And if you haven't, please take advantage of the opportunity to pick up a copy here. He has since left the military and is studying to become a barrister. Please join me in welcoming Patrick to the FCC. It's his first visit to Hong Kong. Patrick, thanks for coming today.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon. Very kind introduction. I should point out that Bosnia was hardly a hotspot when I was there. It was middle of December. There was absolutely nothing exciting going on. And about the most dangerous thing that happened was when the heater broke and everyone was going to have cold showers. So I can't really claim that in the same breath as places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And I should also apologize for wearing quite such a cliched suit. One of my first things I did when I joined my regiment was go on a training exercise to Malaysia. And with all the sort of arrogance and impecuniosity of young guards officers, we were frog marched down to the local tailor and made to buy extraordinary tropical suits. It doesn't get a lot of wearing, so I thought if I'm coming to Hong Kong, I might as well get it out. It's quite Martin Bell, so I was kind of hoping it was suitable for your lovely club. Nervous is not the right word, but I thought twice about what I was going to say when I came here, because obviously, Foreign Correspondence Club, one of the things that got attention in my book, and I wouldn't be so cynical as to suggest I put it in on that purpose, but I wasn't overly complimentary about journalists. I think the army, the armed forces, you'll have to forgive me, I'm an infantier, I'm a soldier, I kind of talk in terms of army, and I know we exist in a joint operating environment and blah, 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 but it's just my background. We have this strange kind of symbiotic relation with journalists, particularly the embedded journalists you get in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And I kind of think of it as being quite similar to the relationship that the English have with the French, where we sort of dislike each other because we're actually so similar. I think what drives a lot of soldiers is quite similar to what drives a lot of the more intrepid foreign correspondents. But there is this unease in that relationship, and there's kind of a sense that you probably have in families, where families can be as rude as they like about each other, but if you're not in the family, then you shouldn't be rude about the family. And some of my experiences with embedded journalists was that we felt somehow that these guys were treading on the toes, or they were being rude. And so when I wrote the book, one of the pitches was that you get a lot of stuff that is ghostwritten, a true soldier's story, and it's quite one-dimensional. It's very entertaining, it's very exciting. Andy McNab style thrillers, but possibly a lack of insight. And then you also get some fantastic writing, largely by kind of journalists, people like Roy Stewart, Jason Burke, spring to mind. But it is that journalistic perspective, and I wanted to try and write with the clarity and intelligence that these journalists were writing with, but from the soldier's perspective. So I was aware that there was this kind of thing. And I think it's a relevant friction, if friction is the right word, to bring up, because it goes right to the heart of why I wrote the book at all, which is to overcome a kind of perception gap. I haven't done many talks like this, certainly not somewhere as kind of special as this place and to such a distinguished audience. And usually I'm either talking to young officers at Sandhurst, the Officer Training Academy, in which case I sort of tell them why it's so important that they should always put their body armor on, and I'll try not to tell you guys to kind of lead from the front or whatever it is that I say to them. Or I talk to charity functions, and it's kind of like preaching to the choir, because it's mostly 55-year-old ladies who lunch and raise a bit of money for Help for Heroes, and you're a kind of young former army officer and you can't really do anything wrong. And of course the great thing about speaking to kind of clinical minds, the likes of people who be at the Foreign Correspondents Club, is they are going to ask these questions and they're going to pose them, and they're questions that need to be posed. But I was very struck of how strange this relationship is, and how there is this understanding gap or perception gap, however you want to label it. When I came back from Afghanistan in 2007, and I'd had embedded with me, or with my unit, a documentary team from BBC's Panorama, which is a program I'm sure everybody will be quite familiar with. And these two guys, they were both brilliant journalists. It was quite amusing. When we first met them, they were quite sort of, I don't think they'd mind me saying, they were quite kind of cocky. And one of them was telling all these stories about he'd been here, he'd been there, he'd been ambushed here, he'd been kidnapped there. If anything, you know, if it all went wrong, we could ask him for advice rather than vice versa. And then he came out on patrol on the first day into the green zone of Helmand Province, which, as you'll have seen from pictures, or some of you may even have been there, it's extremely dense, it's extremely lush. It's kind of almost like sort of low canopy jungle rather than anything else. And he had a red rucksack, which we didn't really appreciate within that environment. So that was our kind of, that was our first question mark. And then we got in a reasonably punchy scrap, but nothing too out of the ordinary, unfortunately, for that part of the world. And within about 20 minutes, these guys wanted to go home. So we were like, well, I thought, what about your kind of ambushes here and there? But we ended up, we all got on really well, and they were great guys. And they made a really good film, and it was nominated for some awards. And I felt they had got some amazing footage of the Afghan National Security Forces. It was my great privilege to work alongside the Afghan National Army. I think it's something we don't talk about enough, we don't understand enough, and is arguably a success story. And they'd got some amazing footage of how these guys operate, and they're such colourful characters. And this film came out, and we all got to go and see it at the Frontline Club in London, which I guess is sort of not dissimilar institution to this. And everybody thought it was fantastic. My mum hated it. She was like, you told me you were going to be in a camp for 7 months. It wasn't going to be dangerous. You were lying. I was like, yeah, I was trying to. But mostly everybody really liked it, except these guys, fellow journalists. And this kind of came as a real shock to me. But the criticism that they received in a lot of quarters was, you've become too close to your subject. Where's the dispassionate side? Where's the critical side? And it's a really interesting criticism, because it is obviously, it's so important to maintain that dispassion. But it's very difficult. I think one of the crises we have at the moment with the conflict in Afghanistan is Helmand is so dangerous that you can count on the fingers of one hand the journalists who operate there independently. Basically, if you want to go and report from Helmand, you have to be embedded. And that means that you live in an army camp, and you live and work alongside a unit who are fighting, and who you're going on patrol with, and who you're coming back from patrol with, and you're living with. And it's very difficult not to become too close. And I don't have a solution to that particular conundrum. I just think it is very interesting that these guys got criticized for coming too close to us. So on a number of occasions, we sort of saved their lives. I think it was only, you know, they cut us a bit of slack, perhaps. That was understandable. But it also goes to something deeper, and it's something that, if I wonder whether it it's part of this problem that I suggested, this perception gap, and why there might be a sort of friction between soldiers and journalists reporting on them. Because journalism seems to be so often concerned with a kind of quest for a truth, or looking for something, and the excitement is the idea that that something is hidden, because then obviously finding it is more valuable. I fear that sometimes we're looking for something either that isn't there or that is distracting us from a bigger picture. And I'll give you another example of this. I was called to go and speak on the television to comment on something that had happened in Sangin, where a number of guys had been killed in a very sophisticated IED attack. And this was just after my book had come out. And it's been a very topical thing this summer. You know, Afghanistan in the United Kingdom has become a huge political football. And when I try and tell people at a talk like this that one of the reasons why I wrote the book was that no one was talking about Afghanistan, I look like I'm mad, because now it's all that anyone was talking about. But certainly when I came home in 2007, everyone was talking about Big Brother or, you know, the new football season. And that was a source of real anger among troops. They'd been fighting for their lives in the conflict that it wasn't even then the most important conflict we were fighting, let alone the kind of headline news. So that has changed. But I was called in. The book had just come out. And I know he didn't mean it crassly, but 8 guys had been killed that day, which is the biggest loss of life for the British in about 2 years. And actually, they'd all been killed in different incidents rather than usually when a lot of people die, it's because a helicopter or a plane has come down. So it was kind of quite poignant. And the young AP or whatever he was, the guy who'd been sort of sorting everything out, scurrying around the Newsnight studio, just sort of said, "Oh, thanks so much for coming in." And he said, "Yeah, you've just had the book out. I've seen some good reviews. You must be loving this." I said, "Well, what, you mean the 8 of my sort of former colleagues and some of my friends who've just been died? Not so much." And it came up again very recently when some people I was much closer to were shot by an Afghan national policeman about 3-4 weeks ago in the Babaji area of Helmand province. And again, I was sort of being farmed out and sat there, sort of whatever it was, Channel 4 News, and speaking before we were going on. And it struck me that this, you know, this was being seized upon by the kind of the news channels in the United Kingdom as a great example of a failure. You know, we've been being told all summer by people like me that the exit strategy for Afghanistan is enabling Afghan national security forces, and yet here's an example of Afghan national security forces biting the hand that feeds them. And there was a tremendous enthusiasm, and I would say a slightly indecent haste to jump on the bandwagon that this incident in isolation proved that the entire strategy was flawed, nothing was ever going to work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I put it to the person I was on with. I said, I did this job. I mentored Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police for 7 months, and then I ran the training for the British soldiers and the American soldiers who were going to go and do that mentoring for a further year. I saw illiterate groups of 200 men who'd never met each other formed into effective fighting units, and no one ever invited me to go on television and talk about it. One guy shoots some people, and we can't get it off the news. And so I wonder if there's perhaps a sort of an interesting thing where the old adage of good news isn't news becomes a problem. I wrote the book, my book, because I was invited by a friend of mine who works for a magazine to write a small article for his magazine. It's called The Literary Review in London. No, it's got a readership of about 30, and 10 of those are my mum buying it because her son was writing for it at the time. But the one thing they do, which you might have heard of, is they run the annual Bad Sex Awards, which is where 6 writers from the previous year are nominated for the worst, most cringe-inducing passage of bad writing of sex in a novel, and are ritually humiliated at this function in London. And they get these wonderful hammy actresses, and they read out these passages, and whoever it is stands there very grumpily and receives this horrible award: "You are the worst writer of sex in the country." And the whole thing is sponsored by Hendrick's Gin, so you get absolutely hammered. As you know, there's no one worse than writers and publishers for free booze. So we'd been at this thing, and this was before I went to Iraq for the first time. And Phil said to me, "Write something for the Literary Review." And our first idea was I'd write a book review, but from Iraq. And I think what we'd kind of thought was be really funny, something inappropriate, like an Aga saga being reviewed during a mortar attack. So it was like, you know, as a thud shook the tent, I was surprised to learn that Julia was having an affair with the vicar or something. And then we realized, as anyone who's written a book will know, there's nothing worse than the review being more about the reviewer than the book itself. So we thought, actually, that's a bit unfair. And so I sent him an email saying, I'm now out in Iraq, very hot, what do you want me to do? And Phil, this guy, he's a really bright guy, contemporary of mine at Oxford, journalist, writer, kind of Renaissance man. And he sent me this email back saying, well, why don't you find a small independent bookshop in Basra that's managed to stay open all the way through the war? Or maybe somebody's starting up a literary festival in Baghdad. This is 2006. This was the summer. This was the beginning of the surge. There wasn't a shop in Basra, let alone a small independent bookshop with kind of mahogany shelves, which was selling kind of nice signed first editions of something out of Notting Hill. You know, up in Baghdad, the morgues were pulling in kind of 9,000 bodies a month, half of whom had been executed by Iraqi police. You know, there was no one setting up a literary festival. There were people trying to survive. And I couldn't get away from the idea that this intelligent contemporary of mine, by no means had his head in the sand, by no means was ignoring facts. He had no clue what was going on. It struck me again a year later, Afghanistan this time. I'd been out clearing the green zone north of a town called Goreshk, which is kind of pretty central to the security of Helmand. And it would be safe to say things had gotten slightly silly. This operation was supposed to last about 5 days, and we were on day 14. And we've been taking casualties and taking a couple of lovely, a really English instance, great friend of mine, got shot in the right thigh. I came over the radio and said, you know, I've been shot, I'm applying a tourniquet, and we managed to drag him back to the company sergeant major, and he was slightly woozy on morphine by that stage. And he said, brilliant officer accent, he said, company sergeant major, am I going to lose my leg? The company sergeant major said, no, sir, no, you'll be fine. He said, oh, good, because life's so much better with both. So this was kind of, it was real stiff upper lip stuff, and we'd started 14 days ago. And actually, I'll tell you, I'm kind of losing my track here, but I will tell you this because it's a good story, especially to tell to kind of a club with the journalists in. The first day of the operation, my other friend, I was one of three platoon commanders. The guy got shot in the leg later was platoon commander number two. I was platoon commander number one. Platoon commander number three got blown up on the first day of the operation. They're both fine, so I can tell these stories. And actually, I saw them in hospital very soon afterwards, and I just said, I told you so. I'm nothing wrong with me. You two don't listen. But he had been blown up by an IED. And he was a big Nigerian guy. Big hoo-ha was made when he joined the regiment. I tried to say, commanding officer said, we've got to make a thing of this. He's the first black officer in our regiment. And I said, sir, you don't want to make a thing about this. He said, why not? I said, well, A, because he's not. Apparently, there was a guy called Prince Freddie of Uganda. He sounds like he wandered out of an Evelyn Waugh novel, but apparently he was a sort of in the 60s. And also because it's 2007, sir, people are not going to read the paper and go, oh, good, the guards have got their first black officer. They're going to go, what the hell have they been doing for the last 30 years? But, you know, so off he goes. Then this poor guy was always in the sun. He was always, it became his kind of, you couldn't write his name without afterwards, first black guards officer. And he had been blown up in the leg, so taken some shrapnel. We pumped him full of morphine, and we'd had to sort of cut away all his clothing to sort of get to the wound, and we evacuated him to a casualty extraction point. Really, one of the young guardsmen, it was the first instance he'd been in. I was so proud of this guy. He was kind of training kicked in. He was doing really well, and he was trying to keep him conscious, and he was saying, talk to me, sir, you've got to keep talking. And guy was woozing in and out of consciousness. He said, sir, come on, anything at all. Right, recite me the alphabet. And we were going, Garson Riddle, he's went to Harrow. He doesn't know the alphabet. Don't even go down that line. That will not work with this guy. But the chopper came in, and we have these the medical emergency response teams, the MERTs, these Chinook-born evacuation crews, who are just absolute heroes, very overused word, but they have come into some situations where no one else would land, and you know if you get on the back of one of those helicopters, you're probably going to be all right, and that's a wonderful thing when you're fighting on the ground. The helicopter that came in wasn't a medical emergency response team. It was the nearest helicopter, which had been carrying the BBC Radio 1 journalists who'd been doing their week in Helmand from Camp Bastion, which is safe as houses, and were on their way back home to Kandahar and then obviously back onto the UK and no doubt kind of drinks that night in the frontline club telling kind of great stories. And one of their journalists, who I think is a news presenter on radio, was sat at the back. Obviously, kind of someone had given her the nice seat so you can see this beautiful country out of the back door of the Chinook. And she was actually very pretty. I remember thinking, I hadn't pretty much seen a girl that wasn't wearing a burqa for about 3 months at this stage, and I was struck. But she was there in blue helmet, blue body armor, kind of press thing. And Pootling, suddenly her helicopter's taken a turn, dived into the middle of this firefight, and these four guys have run on with this effectively naked black guy with an enormous Johnson flapping in the downdraft of a Chinook, covered in blood, thrown him onto the back of this helicopter. She'd been in Helmand for a week, and she'd been reporting every morning from Camp Bastion where it was very hot and where it was very dangerous because somewhere out there were the enemy. And this was finally Helmand province that had just been chucked onto her lap. And so that was the nature, this is the background of this operation that we'd been on. So I'm the last platoon commander left, and the day before my R&R, which I didn't think I was going to get at that stage, we'd been ambushed quite far forward and were stuck on a rooftop, a very small rooftop, about 10 foot by 10 foot. Me and three other British soldiers and then about 20 Afghans who were also on a couple of other roofs. For about 14 hours, there was this kind of to and fro where the Taliban would come up quite close and be firing down off the roofs. Then we'd call in some air support and they'd back off. And this went on and on. It got really silly, and you know, we didn't know whether we were going to get off the roof. The humour got quite black. The one female Harrier pilot in the Royal Air Force dropped a bomb on us instead of the Taliban. It was going well. It was a good day, but we got pulled off this roof and we got back for our R&R. And unlike when you finish a tour, where there is now wonderful decompression facilities for UK soldiers in Cyprus, for R&R you get chucked straight home. And so within 48 hours of having been on this roof, I'm on the King's Road, and I'm overwhelmed by the kind of colour and the sights and the smells and everything. And I went to go and see a friend of my father's. He'd very kindly invited me to tea in the House of Parliament, in the wonderful Pugin Rooms, kind of poshest tea room in London. And I was sat there with these MPs, tea cakes and Earl Grey, a million miles away from where I'd been 48 hours earlier. And they were all congratulating themselves, because that was the day they decided they were going to have a minute's silence every time somebody died before the start of business in the House. And again, rather like when my friend Phil just didn't understand Iraq, it came home to me so clearly at that moment. These guys didn't have a clue. They were sort of backslapping because we're going to have a minute's silence. And 48 hours before, I'd been doing this stuff, which they couldn't possibly have imagined from the sort of the comfort of the House of Commons. And I think that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted to kind of try and speak a language that people would understand, but talk about things from a first-hand perspective. And I think that's also why the relationship between journalists and soldiers, frictious at times though it may be, is so important. Because actually, we could be winning the war in Afghanistan, which in certain respects I think it is happening, and it doesn't matter if it's not understood at home. If my book was able to do anything, I kind of wanted it to promote a debate, and so I was deliberately shocking in some places, and I'm more than happy. When I'm finished speaking, we'll take lots of questions. I'm sure your questions will be much better than anything I can kind of stand up here and say, and I'm sure we'll get into some kind of really interesting kind of political stuff. I'm not particularly political either way. I just happen to sort of spend most of my time beating up the current government because I don't think they're doing it very well. I don't necessarily know that anyone else would do it better. But I wanted a book that people would read who wouldn't go in to the bookshop and buy a military book. I wanted a book that maybe more women would read because traditionally the people who read military literature are men. And thereby to kind of prompt this debate. And so I kind of speak, I guess, in a way to those of you who are kind of journalists who do work in media, because I think that there is a responsibility to kind of keep that debate to the fore, to keep it informed, because I think it's very often been ill-informed, to help understand the context, which is something I was very keen in my book, not to just talk about Helmand and not to just talk about Baghdad, but to talk about being back in the UK, being in Sandhurst, being on training, so that people understood what was going on in and around the military context. Because it is rare these days. We have a very small army in the United Kingdom, and people don't necessarily know someone who's served, or they don't have a family member who's served. And so there is this gap, and I want to try and bridge that gap. And it's so important, because actually I can only sort of write a book, and some people notice it just because I was quite young when I did it, and I trade off that until I'm not young anymore, and then someone else will do it. But the media keep it there front and center the whole time. And we're seeing, even this week, you know, there'll be a fresh inquiry into abuses of Iraqi prisoners of war that may or may not have happened. How that is reported is so important, because if unsubstantiated allegations are reported as fact, that can be damaging. At the same token, if things that are potentially damaging aren't reported at all, that's a terrible thing. So keeping this balance, I think, is so difficult, which is why the kind of questions constantly need to be asked. And I guess I'm just sort of looking at my watch because I want to allow enough questions, enough time for questions. I guess my contribution to bridging this gap, but I should say my father was in the Navy, so I sort of had a military background. He was in the first Gulf War in the 90s. I remember very clearly my mother. I was just about old enough to understand something was not quite right, because he'd been far too nice to us for about a month before he went away. And then my mother was kind of ironing furiously at about midnight to Verdi's Requiem, watching BBC News. And it was the first nearly 24-hour news war, Gulf One. But my little sister didn't understand at all. And when people used to say, oh, your father's away, isn't he? She'd say, yes, he's playing golf for 6 months. And I always thought that was the rather benign example of an understanding gap. That's fine. She was 4 years old. She's allowed to misunderstand, and it was quite sweet. I think given that we have politicians and policy formers and decision makers and a kind of urban media and professional elite who really have no touchstone with what the military does, I think there are inexcusable misunderstandings. And I think that's why what a lot of you guys do and what I try to do is so important. So my conclusion would be just keep on bridging that gap. Keep on reporting stuff that is important, and I'll keep writing about stuff, and I'm hoping to get back out to Helmand this Christmas to one of my friends who's still in the army that hasn't got a backgammon partner in his patrol base, so I said I'd go and give him a hand. But I think always trying to look for the other thing, not the obvious one, not just the I'll tell a good war story about Helmand, which obviously is what I did, so I've already cashed in on it, too late. But the other question, instead of having endless news reports where Afghanistan is only heard on our news when someone's died, why don't we have a leading story one day where something good has happened? That's what I think is slightly lacking. So as I said, I look forward to taking your questions, and I'd like to thank you all very much for having me here. And the last thing that I'd like to do before I finish is a plug for the other events that I'm in Hong Kong for this evening, which is a charity function for Help for Heroes in the penthouse suite at Jardine House, which is the first Help for Heroes event in Hong Kong. Help for Heroes is a great example of what I've been speaking about, a charity that was set up because we didn't have the facilities in the United Kingdom. There wasn't enough money to give proper rehabilitation to soldiers who've been injured. I think that's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about. So it's why if anybody does have a spare thing to do this evening, come along and give generously to those sort of charities, because they're very worthwhile. But thank you all.
Patrick, thank you very much for a really fascinating talk. We do have about 15 minutes for questions. We're usually pretty strict about wrapping up bang on 2 o'clock, but even a cynical foreign correspondent can recognize when we've got a star on our hands, so if the questions do run over a bit, I'm happy to let that happen, but don't be shy about rushing off at 2 if you have to. Throw it open to the floor, and please do identify yourself when you ask your question. Right here, please.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. Do you think it helps the cause at all by having the likes of Ross Kemp coming out to Afghanistan, or is that dumbing it down?
I spent some time with Ross Kemp while he was there, and he was actually, I think everyone was prepared to hate him, especially because he'd been in a program back in the UK called Ultimate Force, which is a sort of the worst non-SAS program you can ever imagine on rubbish TV. I think what he did has a purpose, and I think it was part of something slightly different from kind of reportage, which was we had a problem in the United Kingdom, a legacy of the Iraq conflict, where there was a confluence of people's I'll say it, kind of justified lack of support for that conflict, and therefore them not wanting to support their military. And I think one of the great achievements of General Sir Richard Dannett, who was the outgoing Chief of the General Staff, was he managed to invoke the military covenant and create an environment where you could be against what a government was asking an army to do and still support the young men and women who were doing very difficult tasks. I think Ross Kemp was part of that. I think he bought the reality of what was happening in Helmand province into the homes of people who otherwise wouldn't have got it because they weren't kind of digesting the sort of media that went into detail in that, and thereby kind of contributed to the groundswell of public support for our boys, kind of to use that inverted commas phrase. I'm not sure it was necessarily useful in posing questions or answering questions about tactics and indeed strategy.
In the middle here, please.
Hi, I'm Bob Meyer. Thank you for your remarks. You alluded in your comments that in certain ways you think perhaps the war is being won there. I wonder if you could address yourself to that and also address what you think the Americans are likely to do in terms of the decision whether to put in another surge and what the chances of success really are from your standpoint.
I think what I always kind of characterize myself as a cautious optimist. And one of the things I found that optimism on is the degree of skepticism about the possibility of success. And I think we do have to be careful how we define success, but the degree of skepticism about that I find diminishes in proportion to how close you get to the front line. So that the most vehement pessimists are sitting at home on sofas in London, and the soldiers who are spending 6 months and every 2 years in Afghanistan are very clear about why they're there and what they're doing. And as I say, I was very lucky because I was working with Afghans, the vast majority of whom I spoke to could not have been more welcoming. I was talking to some guys informally last night, and I encountered again this kind of classic jumbling together of Iraq and Afghanistan. So this guy said to me, "What are you doing in Afghanistan? You invaded a country. People don't." I said, "No, we didn't. We really didn't. I know people don't like this, but we are in Afghanistan at the invitation of the Afghans. And when we took casualties, I had this humbling thing of Afghan commanders who'd lost their own soldiers in the same actions coming up to me and saying, 'I'm so sorry that you've lost your men. You know, we should be showing you better hospitality than this. We're aware of the sacrifices you're making to try and help us.'" Ordinary Joe Afghan on the streets in Sangin, in Kandahar, and especially up in places like Mazar-i-Sharif and Herat in the north, where I think the security situation is very different, and we kind of characterize Afghanistan and then we think about regional command south, very different in different parts of the country. They just want to get on with their normal lives without the threat of being blown up and without being oppressed. And they recognize that if International Security Assistance Force wasn't there, there would be less collateral damage, there'd be less fighting, but they would also be being abandoned to a civil war, probably, and almost certainly some form of regime, which would be worse, I think, than what is currently being lived through. Everybody I spoke to, local elders, said, "This is not a great country at the moment, let's make no mistake about that. But it is a better country than it was in 1999, where public executions were de rigueur, where, you know, we all know what the oppression of women was like in Afghanistan under the Taliban." And I get very cross when people say to me, "Oh, girls going to school is a trite argument." It's not a trite argument. It's 2009, and I had the privilege of going into villages where the teacher had been beheaded and where a 14-year-old girl had been beaten with a stick because she was being taught by him. And I had the privilege to push the sort of monsters that would do that out of that village and then set up security for it so that everybody could go to the new school that was opened. And I think that is a measure of success. And I think that that side isn't being as widely reported as the losses that are being taken.
A woman in the back, please.
I'm Aileen Bridgewater, freelance. Patrick, I've been very interested to hear your talk because my 20-year-old grandson is currently on his second tour in Henmaan, Afghanistan. Next Tuesday, Barack Obama is going to announce his statement on US strategy. What will be the impact on the British strategy?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because on this very discreet topic, the government has actually done something quite clever for once. And I think the announcement in London that we would commit extra troops, albeit not as many as we need or were asked for, and subject to conditions which you can be confident won't be met. So, I mean, it's a very, very qualified commitment. But it did have an effect, and I know it sort of got up a few noses in Washington, of trying to put this forward. People who know far more about this sort of thing than I do have read the McChrystal plan. I have read the McChrystal plan, and one of the most common responses to it is, "This is such common sense. It's good stuff. It's a good plan. If I were Quetta Shura Taliban, if I were any of the groups that are currently sitting wherever they're sitting in the Durand line, I would be scared reading the McChrystal plan online, because I would be reading a document that I think could defeat me, whatever that means. And I think the delay, I understand the delay, I can kind of picture the scene, Obama's wringing hands, but I think he needs to come out unequivocally in support of this. Because just as I've been talking about perception at home in the United Kingdom or in the States, the perception in Afghanistan is key, and we mustn't underestimate how much of a morale boost insurgent forces get if they think support is wavering at home, and also how much that plays on, as I say, this ordinary guy, you know, Joe Afghan in the middle of Sangin. If he thinks that our agenda is damage limitation and as quickly a withdrawal as possible without being embarrassing, of course he's going to side with the Taliban, because he knows they're going to be around for longer. The unequivocal statement of commitment and support, X thousand more troops, this sort of planning, this sort of approach, an approach which has been proven in other parts of the world, which is going to work better than what we're doing at the moment, which is not quite enough in all the different places, he's going to see that and think, actually, yeah, this is the side I want to be on. So I think it's really important that that comes out. And I think it's really important that Obama comes out in support of it as well.
If I may, and following up on that question, really, I appreciated all your comments and focus on relationship with journalists. I was curious about relationship with the septics, the Yanks. How were relations with your American counterparts at officer and troop level, and could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not just saying this because I'm sort of flanked up here. I was always a kind of unashamed kind of Americophile. I think there was a very lazy and frankly ignorant characterization of the American forces in sort of through 2003, 2004, 2005 as kind of people who did a heavy-handed overmatch and weren't sophisticated. And we got stung. The British Army were sort of so busy crowing about how good we were at counterinsurgency because of the experience we'd gained in Ulster, and oh, look at us, we're walking around the streets of Basra in berets. Well, you know, Basra was Shia. They didn't want Saddam Hussein there anyway, and we still managed to make a mess of it. The commitment that the American armed forces were making elsewhere in Iraq, the commitment that they have in Afghanistan is mind-boggling. And the men and materiel that they lose is heartbreaking. And I think anybody that thinks we couldn't do any of the things that we do without the Americans is deeply mistaken. I think as an armed forces, we have a lot to learn from the way the American armed forces learn from their mistakes. I think they are much better at adapting. They're much more receptive to change. There's a motto, the US Marine Corps Training Battalion, who are called the Coyotes, have a motto which says, let no man's ghost say, I wish I'd been better trained. Now, the first reaction to that, if you're English like I am, is it's about the cheesiest thing you've ever heard, and you want to go and be sick. But the second thing is you think about it on a more considered level, and that is an utterly laudable sentiment. And it seems nonsensical to me that we don't have in the British Armed Forces that same professionalism and that same sentiment to training. So I think I was in a majority among people who served, was always more than happy when there was Americans overhead or behind or alongside.
Were they ever in front?
No.
Chris.
As an American, I'm not really sure where to take that. But actually, I won't defend the American military and where whatever position they have, but I will try to defend the hacks a little bit, because I think that your criticism of some of the coverage of Afghanistan in particular is very, it's your experience, and certainly I wouldn't take that, you know, take issue with that. But I do have some concerns about the idea that journalists are being too critical and trying to look for problems and trying to look for mistakes, because I think that's the most common sort of charge that's laid against us in these circumstances. But, I mean, by God, there have been some horrific things that have come out that journalists have uncovered, and that were it not for dogged pursuit of those stories, the world would not know, and the military must be held accountable for that. And I'm not saying the British military, and I'm not saying your regiment or anything of that sort, but it's just as a general sort of, you know, our two tribes, you know, that's kind of what has to happen.
I couldn't agree more, and I should sort of probably clarify, but I'll try and do so by way of a couple of concrete examples, because perhaps they're easier to then assimilate. I think you're right. What I worry about is that sometimes there is an imbalance, and there's a rather instructive example from 2003, when subsequent to the taking of Baghdad, well, the two incidents actually from 2003. One, anybody who was digesting the BBC during the first phase of the Second Gulf War, what we call Telic 1 in the British military, will have become very familiar with Raggy Omar, the kind of the housewife's favourite. And the kind of perceived, and I do say perceived liberal bias, I'm not sure there is such a thing, and I do think the BBC is an important institution, but the famous report that he made rubbishing the American claims that they had already taken Baghdad, saying, "I can't see any tanks," was conducted with the cameraman moving around him so that the tanks which were behind him weren't in shot. About 2 days later, an enormous cache of medical supplies that had been being hoarded by the Ba'athist Party was discovered. And obviously, one of Saddam Hussein's kind of key propaganda tools was that, you know, the parlous state of Iraqi healthcare that was enforced by sanctions, and this was the equivalent of medical supplies that would have run an NHS hospital for months. And the BBC were invited, with a lot of other news agencies, to come and cover this very significant find, and declined to do so. So I think that where the balance comes in, to be more contemporary, the current reporting of allegations of abuse of Iraqi detainees, some of those allegations are terrible things, and if there is they must be investigated, and if there's anything in it, the perpetrators must be punished. But we lump together some quite serious allegations with some also kind of slightly, and I say this carefully, I don't mean to diminish anything, but some of these things are slightly silly. I had a very, be careful what I say here because my camera's on, I had a very close relationship with some of the elements of detainee handling in 2006, fortunately not when any of this is supposed to have gone on. And there are claims, for example, that women soldiers kind of showered naked in front of detainees, which was highly offensive. But, A, that wouldn't have physically been possible, but B, how do you shower without taking your clothes off? And what I sometimes wonder about is that if that things are the levels of subtlety are not examined enough, and that's probably not the reporter's fault, because maybe it's the public's fault for not digesting levels of subtlety. But things are oversimplified, and you're right, they're sometimes oversimplified in support of the military. I disagree. You know, everybody who puts on a uniform, in the words of The Sun, is a hero. Well, you know, hero is quite a limited thing. A lot of them are guys who are doing a hard job and trying to do it well, but they're not heroes. But by the same token, somebody who has a shower without leaving their T-shirt on is not a war criminal. And I think, so it's always those shades of grey. The great treat with the book was being able to write 200 pages of shades of grey, and I think we need more grey in our reporting.
I guess there are more questions from the floor. Angus against the wall, and we'll work our way across. And again, I am going to let this run on past time, so if you do have to dash it too, please.
I've got nowhere to go. I'm happy to.
All right. Stay until four.
I'm Angus Forsyth, with no affiliation. Am I right in saying that I would see the reason for British forces being there, or any foreign military forces being there, as being two, essentially? One, to resist Taliban encroachment into the country. Two, to train the Afghan National Army, which is a point you touched on earlier and we're going to come back to. Is that accurate? And if it is accurate, are both of these working, and in which order should they be prioritized?
I think what you've touched on is a really good example of what we were just talking about, where there hasn't been shades of grey. One of the common criticisms at home at the moment is of mission creep. And people say, we went into Afghanistan in November 2001 to find whoever was responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York, and to overthrow the Taliban regime. And what we now seem to be doing is state building, nation building. And the common question posed in kind of British, by the British commentariat, I'll say kind of with an eyebrow, oh, look, aren't I clever for raising this question, is, well, which one are we doing? Are we defeating the Taliban, or are we nation building? Again, the shades of grey that everybody who's kind of studied counterinsurgency is crying out to be answered with is you can't do either of those tasks discreetly, and I think you're absolutely right. You can use our existing military force to win a land fight with the Taliban to push them right into the boundaries, to push them into Pakistan. And part of the problem has been, up until now, there hasn't been a response the other side of the border. There is now one of the largest land military operations that's been conducted for decades going on in Pakistan. So that's also helping. But there's no point in doing that if we then win, go home, and they come back into the vacuum. And so that's where the kind of nation building comes in. I think we have clear military success every time we engage the Taliban in infantry fighting. We have overmatch, you would expect that. We are having limited success with Afghan National Security Forces. I'd say the ANA is a real success story. When I was there, there was only one battalion of 37, which you would have said was ready to conduct its own operations. That is now 30 of 37 in the space of 2 years. And you think, my regiment's 353 years old. So these things do take time, so they're happening quite quickly. The police are an area for concern. And also a real area for concern is everything else. Because I would say further, there's no point in having a competent national security force if there's no infrastructure that they're protecting, if the people they're protecting don't even know why they're there, because you don't have a sort of culture of kind of civic participation. So what I would like to see is, alongside an uplift of troop levels, part of the McChrystal plan, I want to see DFID guys in there, I want to see Foreign Commonwealth Office guys in there, I want to see people from industry, from logistics, reconstructing, consulting, not just within a military context, to do that, so that there is, so you're enfranchising the Afghans, so there's something for them to protect once you've gone back.
There was a question here, and then we'll work across at this table, was there? Yeah, right up front, and then just behind you.
My name's Gavin Ure. You alluded briefly, not only in your answers just now, but earlier, to the Afghan National Army, and you indeed even spoke warmly about them. To what extent, but yet in reports we see in the media, they are often in the background to our British-American troops. To what extent are they the story that's missing from Afghanistan, and how well do you think they, or how capable will they be of taking over as and when Allied forces leave?
I'll borrow your phrase. I think they are the story that's missing. I think it's, my book was as guilty of it as anything else, because what people want to read about is what they know. So, you know, the story is our armed forces rather than theirs, but they are extraordinary soldiers. One of the guys I was commanding, He had fought with Massoud, the Lion of the Panjshir, as part of the Northern Alliance. His brother and his father had both been executed in front of him by the Taliban. And he was the most natural soldier I've ever come across. I mean, you'll find criticisms of the Afghan National Security Forces, of their discipline, but you'll be hard-pushed to find a British or American soldier who's worked alongside them who doesn't say these are among the bravest guys I've ever worked with. So I think at that very low anecdotal level, they are a success story, because if nothing else, they are evidence that the vast majority of Afghans don't want to live in some medieval Taliban dictatorship, and they are losing far more guys than we are every day fighting for their homelands, effectively. I think there are kind of concerns about how long it takes to build an army, and training has been a problem, retention is a problem, and recruitment's a problem. If you want to suddenly create a massive armed forces, and the target, I think slightly unrealistic, is 130,000 by 2011, 2012, well, how do you keep standards up and also double the size of an organization? It's very difficult. The anecdotes that we frequently hear about the fact that, oh, you know, they all take drugs, or they're all cowards, or they're all, you know, a common, very silly criticism in the kind of tabloid British press is that they're all gay, as if this is a problem for being soldiers because they happen to hold hands. I mean, there is so much misunderstanding of the cultural difference. Quite frankly, I've worked alongside fantastic soldiers in Western militaries who are functioning alcoholics, and I worked alongside Afghan National Army soldiers who were functioning cannabis addicts. It's a distraction from the wider problems, I think. So I think you're right. The story should be getting them front and centre, because they're now doing quite a lot of stuff on their own, which is good.
A question here, and then the gentleman in the back, please.
Talking to my son recently, who's just back from a year in Afghanistan, he said there was a feeling around that crucial to the success of any concerted push against the Taliban and the warlords would be the timing of it, in particular to try and time it with the poppy harvest. And the Taliban and the warlords are diverted by their efforts in this. What do you think?
I say my personal opinion as if all the other stuff hasn't been my personal opinion. It all kind of very much has, and I'm far too junior to really know anything about anything. But I think the narcotics is a distraction. I really do. I made it my business, as I was saying to these guys over lunch. Every village we'd go into, one of the first things I'd try and do is have a shura with all the local elders, and we'd sit down together and we'd just have a chat about what they wanted from our presence. Did they want us there at all? Had there been problems? One of the first things I said is, I'm not here to destroy your poppy crop. I think this childish line of causation that is drawn between an Afghan poppy farmer and somebody dying on the streets of Glasgow of a heroin overdose is absolute distraction from the matter in hand. And I think there is a shortage, for example, in the NHS of medical grade morphine. Why are we not buying morphine off farmers and using it for legitimate purposes? I think the level of Taliban control exerted over harvest in different areas varies greatly. There are some parts of Helmand where the Taliban have no presence because the people who grow poppy have armed themselves sufficiently to repel them, and they don't want to pay tax to the Taliban. So it's much more complex than the sort of all drugs fund terrorism and then kill people sort of thing.
Can I just something else say?
Yeah.
I wasn't saying that.
Okay,
I was saying that it would be a diversion of some sort for much of the Taliban, not perhaps the whole of the Taliban, or the warlords. They are involved in it, of course, they get a lot of revenue from it, and that if you're going to have this concerted push to make a real success of it, the timing surely would be of some importance.
I think the problem would be, and we saw this on a much smaller level with kind of battle group level operations, maybe kind of brigade minus level operations that coincided with harvest, you really piss off, if you'll excuse my French, the locals who are unable then to harvest. The most animosity I ever received from what I would assume were otherwise kind of neutral people, when I sort of sat down with them and said, what can we do or what can't we do, was when they were saying, why have you been conducting this recent operation? Why have you conducted this particular mission when it's quite clear that, you know, me and my whole family are out in the field trying to get this done? So I wouldn't know, as I say, specifics, but I think the value of disruption would have to be balanced against how much you'd lose public support for that sort of that operation.
Sir, and then perhaps we have time for one last question.
George McKenzie, ex-son of the Raj, Gurkha Rifles, sometime writer here and there, and spent one night in your guardroom, Stanley. Thanks to Lieutenant Sir Jamie Harvey, Bruce Buck, but we'll tell that one.
That's far off.
Anyway, now this isn't a question, it's more a statement that you would like me comment on and the rest. I think, quite frankly, and I'm being pessimistic, there is no win in this war in Afghanistan. And I think that your politicians drinking their Earl Grey should go and dust off the dust from their history books in the shelves and go back to what the real crisis of this whole thing is. And that is because the British government at the time drew lines on the map of India and Pakistan and did it far too fast. And Jinnah's doctor didn't tell everyone he had cancer. And the big problem is that are the tribal states that are in Pakistan. These people do not want to be part of Pakistan. And they're basically like the clans of Campbells and McDonalds and things like that, and McGregors of way back 12th, 13th century. And they are breeding grounds for the Taliban. These tribal states wanted to be part of Kashmir. And so as it is now, they are breeding grounds for Taliban, and we are going in, and let's not face it, I mean, the British, right through the days of the Raj and Victoria, 60 times they went into Afghanistan, no go.
And the Russians, his pessimism?
Two things. I mean, I'll bow to your kind of clearly superior scholarship. I'm not an expert on the sort of history. I think you're broadly right in what you say, and perhaps on the one hand the politicians should go and dust off their history books, but on the other hand, we have 9,500 troops currently in Helmand province. There are nearly 100,000 ISAF troops in Afghanistan. There are local Afghans who are dying, and there are current terrorist threats to Western cities. And I think it would be a dereliction of duty if we kind of spent too much time revising our history and not enough time addressing the problem which is on the table. The wider questions you pose, I think, are very relevant. But what I would caution against too much, because I hear it a lot at home, is the kind of the great, well, the British Empire couldn't do it and the Russian Empire couldn't do it, so why do we think we could do it? And I come back to this distinction that the Russian Empire invaded Afghanistan, and there was an almost unique coming together of Afghan factions who usually hate each other in order to repel that invader. And I think we are not an invader. So I'm not as pessimistic as you, and I draw my optimism from the fact that the diaspora of kind of Tajiks and Hazaras and all the sort of factions you refer to, particularly in the north of Afghanistan, they are currently kind of on our side rather than against us, and we have to capitalize on that for the moment. The one problem I think with that is, as we all know, no one has any money for anything at the moment, so we probably couldn't afford it.
The last question against the wall, please, sir.
Thanks, Rick. No affiliation. You mentioned talking to the Afghans, asking them what they want. Presumably you don't speak Afghan and they don't speak English in many instances, so you're relying on interpreters. Can they be trusted? And secondly, everybody knows that the police are corrupt beyond anything that we've ever seen in our lifetime. Can anything be done on the police side of, you know, the local civilian police force?
I worked with a number of interpreters, one of whom was very bad. I actually got picked up on this in a review. I mentioned him disparagingly because he was passing information about what we were doing onto the Taliban, and I got accused of characterizing all interpreters as bad. Most of the interpreters I worked with were absolutely fantastic. I was very lucky. I managed to pick up little bits here and there of Dari, which is the official language of the Afghan army, so I could tell just about if things weren't being translated properly. And I think by and large these guys are trustworthy because they risk so much to themselves by working with foreign forces that if their commitment was in question, they just frankly wouldn't do it. They're not actually all that well paid, even within the context of such a poor country. With the corruption of the police, in fact, I think with corruption in general, I mean, I find this, it kind of almost kind of makes me smile when I sort of say, especially back at home, you know, what sort of country has a leader that has never actually faced a public vote properly and politicians who are more interested in skimming off the top than representing their country? And then I go, hang on, am I talking about Afghanistan or am I talking about the United Kingdom? I mean, I think in the same way that we have to reappraise our idea of a win and we have to be a bit more culturally sensitive. You know, the fact that Afghan National Army soldiers smoke cannabis doesn't mean they're not efficient. I think we have to be careful about, as you said, sort of corruption unlike anything we've ever seen in our lifetime. I mean, I think corruption happens. The corruption of the Afghan National Police Force is to do with family loyalties and it's to do with tribal loyalties. And they are not going to be eradicated by sending these guys on a kind of an anti-corruption course. I think what we need to do is be a bit more intelligent about how we work within those systems. So perhaps by making sure, as we try and do with the Afghan National Army, that if a particular ethnicity dominates within a unit, that unit isn't posted to a part of the country where that is going to become a problem. And actually what we try and do is make sure no ethnicity does particularly dominate. So I had mixed platoons of Northerners and Southerners so that there couldn't be any accusation of racism by the Northerners and by collusion with the Southerners. So I think we need to be as flexible as we need to expect the Afghans to kind of work at overcoming that.
Patrick, just because I think the audience will be interested in this, can we just wrap this up? Could you just mention very briefly why you've decided to go into law? And just as an addendum to that, given the emphasis of so much of your talk today and how important you think it is, did you not consider journalism?
I put my cards on the table. It's probably abundantly clear from everything I say that I'm sort of slightly unashamed, kind of old school liberal interventionist. The reason why I joined the army were reading books like Romeo Dallaire's Shake Hands with the Devil about what happened in Rwanda, and Michael Rowe's Fighting for Peace about what happened in Bosnia, and seeing what happens when we don't step up to the plate. And I think we're all pretty privileged in kind of rich Western countries, and my personal belief is that that's what we owe back. So that's why I joined the army. Towards the end of my time in it, I was working with some of the legal aspects of what we did, trying to translate sometimes quite obtuse kind of legal directives down to soldiers to make them understand that, you know, the laws of armed conflict wasn't something that had been designed to make it difficult for them to do their job. It was actually just a completely logical moral framework. And in fact, I've seen firsthand in Iraq the difference in fighting an enemy that thinks you're going to treat him well and an enemy that thinks you're going to treat him badly. I think Iraqi regular forces at the very beginning of the Iraq War were much happier to surrender to the Brits than they were to, for example, the Georgians, who were one of the nations in there who had a reputation for being quite rough with their prisoners. So soldiers know better than anybody how important it is to treat other soldiers well. It's kind of fundamental moral law. And so I was working with that, and I think perhaps what I realized is, having had this wonderful busy 5 years in the army and really enjoyed it, if my kind of overriding, probably slightly naive and worthy objectives were making a difference, whatever that means in that vague sense, I could be as effective, if not more effective, doing it within kind of legal frameworks than within military frameworks. I love the idea of journalism, and I sort of do a bit from time to time when they'll let me, seeing as I was rude about them. But I'm also quite greedy, and they tend to be quite poor journalists. Lawyers, journalists.
It's true. We can't promise you much of a future in our industry. Please thank me, and join me in thanking Patrick for a really fascinating talk today. That was terrific.
Thank you.
And as we do after these functions, Andy, could you help me with a presentation of the gift? We have a job contract from the Financial Times. We need a stringer in Kabul. Your mother's not going to like it, but we will.
Thank you very much.
And Patrick is on the record as saying he's got nothing to do for the rest of the afternoon, so I assume that means you can sign some books. If you'd like to get your book signed, please maybe cue from this direction. And thank you all for coming. And remind us, what time is the event tonight at Jardine House?
I think it's 7 o'clock.
And 7 o'clock tonight, top of Jardine House, if you're interested in that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'll probably sneak away as your fans absorb you, but
absolutely. Thank you very much.
And, thank you.
And 936. soon.